Taylor Swift, Kanye West, they are pop stars, not political scientists or anything like that. But when they dole out political advice, people listen. Or at least it makes the news. Why is that? How much does it matter? And when did this start? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking to Mark Harvey. He's the author of a new book called Celebrity Influence: Politics, Persuasion, and Issue-Based Advocacy. It's a book from the University Press of Kansas, and Mark lives here in town. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
This book is very timely, but clearly you have been working on it for a long time. Books don't just appear overnight. What inspired your interest in celebrity endorsements?
Wow. Actually, I'm a musician. And so I have this long-term interest in how music affects people. And originally, I wanted to do a project on the effect of musicians. But the data set, honestly, was a little bit small. And so I thought, well, is it more than just the music? Is it also sort of something else? And so I began looking into sort of people in the public, and particularly celebrities and other entertainers.
Was there a moment involving music or a musician that kind of got the wheels turning here?
That's hard to say. I mean, part of it is my own stage experience. You know, you learn certain tricks as musicians. You sort of like raise the bass in certain ways in order to try to get people. People have a physiological response to that at some point. But also watching artists like Bono from U2, for example, working a crowd, you know, creating an emotional moment. And of course, they were quite political as well. And so part of it was the music itself, but part of it also was just this notion of like, why are people paying attention? And, you know,
what's the answer to that?
Well, things have changed, I think, pretty substantially. I mean, you know, if you look back in the late 60s and in early 70s, where a lot of this stuff really started in earnest, there's a great contrast. The story I like to tell, basically, is Elvis Presley and Richard Nixon, right? Presley, of course, king of rock and roll, baby, you know. Elvis Presley decides that he wants to get a badge and have the ability to carry guns on commercial airlines, and figures he can get that from the president. So he writes him a letter that basically criticizes the countercultural movement, attacks the Beatles for infecting the youth and all this stuff. And
is this a flattery will get you everywhere kind of move?
Maybe. It's hard to say, because very little actually is known about what actually happened, because they had a meeting. They got together. And of course, there's a famous photograph of Elvis Presley and Richard Nixon shaking hands. The funny thing that I think about this that's very telling is that that picture actually did not come out until about 1988. And this meeting was a secret, because neither one of them thought that it would look good for Nixon to be seeing sort of consulting with a celebrity. And so that's where we were in the 60s and 1970s, where, you know, anybody who was seen as a celebrity was really not seen as particularly credible.
Like, I don't want to be associated with that.
Exactly. Right. I mean, Frank
Whereas
Sinatra.
The cover of your book. Can you describe the photo on the cover of your book?
Oh, yeah. This is the great contrast, right? You have George Bush and Bono, again, the lead singer of U2.
George W.
George W. Bush. Thank you. Absolutely. Sort of just grinning in front of the camera, and Bono's looking all cool like a rock star. Peace man, and George Bush look a little bit awkward, but, you know, there they are. And so that's sort of an interesting mystery. How did we start off with this sort of Presley-Nixon moment and then move on toward the situation where not only is it acceptable, but it's kind of encouraged? You can hardly see a president nowadays not gallivanting around with celebrities of one sort or another.
But before we get to that transition, that cultural shift, I am curious about how far back this whole practice goes, because you mentioned that in the 60s and 70s, that's when it started in earnest. But
yes,
it is much older than
it
that.
Is. Yeah. Based on my research, and this actually isn't in the book, I've just done more stuff since then. The earliest instance I can find of celebrity involvement in terms of endorsements in an American political campaign is back in 1920. And Al Jolson and a few other famous actors endorsed Warren Harding for president. Now, I mean, Harding, I should say, Jolson was the premier entertainer of the day. He's somebody everybody knew. He was an actor, a singer, totally famous, sang a campaign song supporting Harding.
He was in the first, quote, talkie, right?
Exactly.
The first movie with actors speaking.
Yeah. And so this was a really, really big deal. However, it's also probably worth noting that you know, I'm not sure exactly how much Jolson really loved Harding. It was actually an association with an ad agency who sort of lined up a few actors to sort of do this, probably to promote the campaign. They turned around and endorsed Calvin Coolidge the next time around. But then after that, it was sort of a wasteland for a while in terms of celebrity involvement. From what I can tell, the next major intervention really is Frank Sinatra endorsing FDR. And again, not being taken very seriously. The Republicans on the other side were calling him a mere crooner, and you shouldn't take this guy seriously.
And that's funny because at least my understanding of Sinatra is that, I mean, he was, his fan base was very broad.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So you would think that as far as controversial figures go, he would not be in that sense.
Well, in that sense, you know, maybe he's a little bit more like Taylor Swift than, you know, say like, you know, John Lennon, for example. You know,
so
not nearly as polarizing.
Let's get into this whole shift, though. Why is it that at one time mere actors are not taken seriously, or mere crooners, mm-hmm. either one, as political advocates, and then, you know, today we have Taylor Swift engaged in a Twitter feud with the President of the United States?
Yeah, well, I think there's actually two questions at play here. I mean, the first one is, you know, why did actors and celebrities, entertainers actually enter the fray in greater numbers? And the second is, how did they become more credible? So the answer to the first question is that contracts changed. Actors were tied exclusively to studios. They didn't have the freedom to really choose movies in the same way they did. It's like if I was working for MGM, I did MGM movies. And if I said something went afoul from the studio, then I could potentially lose my contract. That began to change, particularly with the Beatles in the 1960s, because as these small independent groups, and not independent from record labels necessarily, but you had self-contained groups that were writing their own music and very popular and known sort of more as artists, once they got that degree of independence, then they were able to sort of express themselves much more freely. And part of that also had to do with money. I mean, the Beatles just, you know, blew away record sales like crazy.
So they can do what they want.
They can do what they want. I mean, they actually started saying things like, okay, we are not going to perform in front of segregated audiences, which changed the nature of the way that industry worked. So there's a money aspect that changed this too. So eventually actors became more flexible. Sports figures still are extremely inflexible. I mean, just look at Colin Kaepernick, for example, today. I mean, even today, he's so tied to the NFL, he can be blackballed. And a sign of the times, perhaps, is the fact that Nike basically picked him up as an endorsement, and it seems to be doing quite well. So that's one reason why they re-entered the fray. But as far as the credibility question, you know, part of this also happened when you had a larger number of cable networks going to a 24-hour news cycle, the rise of the internet and eventually social media, where there's a constant demand for content. Right. Now, if you want to be ethical about this, I suppose, and you're a news station, you probably want to spend that time going down the road and trying to find out what's happening at the city council. Well, if you want to sell advertisements, that's not very exciting. And so you kind of try to fill that vacuum with things that are maybe somehow connected to the news, but sexy. Right. And so they start filling this stuff up with all sorts of sexy stuff. And so we start seeing more celebrities. Part of this also, I think, is associated with the fact that since Vietnam and Watergate, we have sort of lost confidence in institutions. It's been on a steady downhill run. We've had a conservative movement that's constantly attacking the efficacy of government. And so this all has to have an effect. And so people increasingly are looking
at... Who do you trust?
Yeah. I mean, it's like the Trump thing. It's like, okay, Trump is perceived by people as being politically independent because he wasn't a politician, right? He was an actor. He was a business person. He had loads of money. And so he can't be bought. And so the same logic applies really to celebrities. It's like, they aren't being bought out by special interests. They can all drain the swamp, so to speak. So it's a weird logic, but I think that that's sort of at play a little bit here.
Particularly with a musician, I feel like, you know, people listen to their favorite musicians in their most vulnerable moments, like by themselves, and feel in a way mm-hmm. like they're speaking to them. And so once you have this feeling of almost friendship with this person who's singing to you, like, mm-hmm. This is my friend giving me advice.
Right. And people buy into that music and they make it their own. The thing that's sort of a slippery slope with that, though, is that when people listen to music, they interpret it in their own way. And there's, you know, it doesn't belong to the artist anymore. And so unless somebody like, say, Taylor Swift comes out and says, this is how I feel politically, people can look at this in all sorts of ways. I mean, consider Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, which is an anti-Vietnam War anthem criticizing the way the government and society are treating veterans. And it becomes an anthem for the Ronald Reagan campaign. Springsteen said, please stop playing that, right? But I mean, it sounds like a patriotic song, but it's not.
That is something that I wanted to ask about. Like, there is this way of flipping it where it's not the politician trying to endorse a candidate. Rather, it's the candidate trying to use, like, the branding around the musician or other celebrity. I'm thinking about music that does get played by campaigns. You often hear this story of the musician going, whoa,
That's right. That's right. And Trump rather famously just sort of said, I'm going to play this stuff anyway. I mean, you know, there are some campaigns, most campaigns, I would say, are fairly respectful. They say, okay, don't play this and they'll stop playing it. And some basically say, well, it works for me, so I'm going to do it anyway.
Does a person's life story ever have anything to do with how credible they are on a particular issue? I'm thinking about the difference between someone like Colin Kaepernick, who has a personal basis, like a lived experience that maybe gives him some credibility on the issue of race, in a way that a photo of Bono with an American politician when he is from Ireland and so forth, like that's different.
Right. Well, based on the research in my book, I found that there were at least two factors anyway that really play into credibility. The first one sort of hits on what you're talking about, and that's a question of identity. Okay. So by and large, what I found is that when it comes to advocating on specific issues, celebrities tend to be as credible or more credible than politicians when arguing on that, which seems sort of counterintuitive because you've got these people who have a level of expertise. But what causes that to some extent, first of all, is identity. So like, say, Elton John or Ellen DeGeneres, they are extremely credible on issues regarding LGBTQ. When it comes to, the second issue is not just identity, but it's also sort of expertise and connections. Okay, so, you know, you mentioned Bono, for example. You know, you might say, well, he's an Irish musician or whatever. You know, you could even play that identity thing to some extent because lots of Americans identify with lots of Irish, so fair enough. But what I found on that end is that it has more to do probably with the institutional connections that he's created. It's not just him. He's surrounded by activists and organizations.
And the work he's done beyond music.
Exactly. He has gone to college to learn about international political economy and can talk a good game. And so there's this level of authority that comes with sometimes those sorts of things. You see similar things with George Clooney, with Angelina Jolie, who's attached to the UN. I mean, the more institutionalized and the more educated they are, the more they are seen as credible.
So this brings us to the big question. How effective is a celebrity endorsement?
We don't know. We don't really have very good answers on that.
Seems like it would be hard to research.
It is extremely hard to research, especially if you're talking about endorsements on candidates, right? Because, I mean, there are so many factors. It's like you've got, are the voters energized? Or, you know, which way is economic issues? I mean, there's a million different things. So to sort of suggest that a celebrity endorsement is going to make or break things is very difficult to say. There is one study, though, that pretty absolutely indicates that there is a connection, at least in one case, and that was Oprah Winfrey's endorsement of Barack Obama in 2007-2008. And political scientists have determined that it probably netted him about a million votes.
Mark Harvey, thanks so much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Mark Harvey's book is Celebrity Influence, Politics, Persuasion, and Influence-Based Advocacy. Mark's also the director of graduate and undergraduate programs at the University of St. Mary in Overland Park. Coming up on KCUR's Central Standard, what's in a name? A lot. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. A A story I heard not too long ago on the Moth Radio Hour has really stuck with me. A guy by the name of R. Eric Thomas remembered being a college freshman without any friends, and one day he walked into the bookstore and saw kind of a trivializing Black History Month display that really offended him. He was so upset that he wrote a sarcastic-sounding editorial in his college paper. It started like this.
Another Black History Month has come and gone. Good riddance. How long must we pay for the penance of this country's sins against Black people? And how much Black history is there really? We all know the drill.
It might be helpful to know Eric is Black. His readers didn't know that.
At the top, of course, it had the title and it had my name. And my name is R. Eric Thomas. Robert Eric Thomas is my full name. And my parents gave me that name, a neutral name, so that nobody would ever look at a job application or a resume and deny me an opportunity because of my race, which is a beautiful and really heartbreaking way of trying to make a world for a person. And it's worked out well for me. I've had a lot of job interviews with racists. But it's true. But here, it presented an issue, because when you're in the wild west days of the internet and you see something, you read something that is sort of a satire but doesn't really written very well, and it says that Black history is irrelevant and Black people aren't important to the history of the country, and it's written by a white guy, you might get your feelings hurt. It went to print on Thursday and up online, and by Sunday I had over 1,000 emails in my inbox. I thought for a brief moment that I had made it. But then I opened them and they said things like, "Dear Whitey, and you are a Klansman and you should die." And I thought, there might have been a misunderstanding somewhere.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and this story of how a name does or does not announce a person's heritage or race gets at what's bugging people about a recent Dear Abby column. A reader asked Abby for naming advice. His wife, who is Indian, wants to give their child an Indian name, and he's feeling conflicted about it. Abby responds, advising against what she calls foreign names because they're hard to pronounce and kids might get teased. KCUR's Kyle Palmer was among the readers who responded to Abby's conventional wisdom on Twitter. Kyle, can you read us your tweet?
Oh, well, yeah, it's good to join you, Gina, but I can read my tweet for sure. This is how I responded to Dear Abby's column. This is what I say. The mild annoyance I feel when people think my son's name is Devin instead of Devden pales in comparison to the pride I feel knowing he will have a unique name the rest of his life that links him to his mom's heritage, plus Devi is a killer nickname.
So talk to me about your son's name and the thought that went into choosing it.
So the column that Dear Abby wrote, or Jeannie Phillips writing as Dear Abby, struck a chord with me because, as you noted, my wife is Indian. And it was very important to her to give our child an Indian name when she was pregnant with him a little more than 2 years ago. And at the time, maybe naively or even a little insensitively, I asked, you know, why this was important for her, because she had been adopted when she was an infant. My wife had not grown up in India, does not know her biological family. So she grew up here in America with an American woman who is, for all intents and purposes, her mother. And so I asked her, why was it important to have an Indian name? Because, internally, I had my own list of names that I had thought of for our son, and with resonance for me and family connections for me. And the way my wife responded, I think, made me see it in a new light and made me understand and appreciate where she was coming from. And she said that since she had grown up in America, had not grown up in India, did not know her Indian family, that this was one of the only ways in which she could pass along her heritage and her birthright to her children. And she wanted her son to know that he was Indian, or at least part Indian.
Yeah, you know, and especially as I think people sort of adapt to this history of the patrilineal last name, there is especially sometimes that matrilineal urge to shape that first name.
Well, there's an addendum to that as well, right? So my wife kept her maiden name, which, again, she's Indian by ethnicity, but her last name is Sagraishik because her mother here in America is from of Slovenian descent. So my wife is is Indian, but has a Minnesota accent and has this Slovenian last name. But so she kept her maiden name when we got married. And so Devdin, his middle name is Zach, Z-A-K, short for his mom's maiden name. And then he has my last name. So, yeah, I think a lot of couples are having these types of conversations nowadays as they name their children and try to, I think, have maybe a more well-rounded and holistic approach to how they pass along their family's names to their kids.
You know, there's this aspect of people's response to this advice column involving her use of the word foreign to mm-hmm. describe certain names and not others. Whereas, like, my name's Gina, that's Italian. I'm not Italian, but that is an Italian name. And that most people's names in this country come from somewhere that is not this soil. And it's sort of interesting that our idea of what is quote unquote American is part of what's at issue here.
Right. And I'll set off on my answer, knowing full well the irony of my name being Kyle in this conversation. But I think what really, if I'm being honest, bugged me about the Dear Abby column the most was this idea that the subtext of her response is that the responsibility or the onus for explaining yourself and getting through life is put on the people with the unique names and the parents of the people with the unique names, and that there's no according sense of responsibility given to people who might tease them, or who are trying to learn and pronounce and spell the names correctly. Like, there should be an according sense of responsibility, and that owes, I guess, to my experience as a teacher before coming to KCUR and just how important I saw names were to the hundreds of students and new students that I had every year. And each one of them wanted their name known and spelled correctly and said correctly.
If Kyle's story or Dear Abby's advice touches a nerve for you, call 816-235-2888 with the story of how your name or your child's name shapes an experience of race or heritage as you move through the world. 816-235-2888. And Kyle, in the story we heard a moment ago from the Moth Radio Hour, a story I happen to just love and recommend listening to in its entirety, but it's about parents of color from another generation trying to protect their kid from racism and discrimination by giving him a name that didn't hint at his ethnicity or race. Is that concern something you thought about?
No, and I will say that I think my wife and I, and I can speak for my wife for this, I think we were operating from a position of relative privilege and being able to say that we could name our kid whatever we wanted to, and we felt fine with that, and we felt fine with his prospects in life. And that is, I think, listening to our Eric Thomas's story, that reminds me of the privilege that she and I had in doing that. So to be frank, no, we didn't consider that as a possibility. And I mean, also to be honest, I mean, Dev is not that hard for people to get. And I think there's a lot of people that know the name Dev. I think a lot of people, when he was very, very young, some of the most common responses we heard were, oh, like the actor Dev Patel from the Slumdog Millionaire movie. So I think the name is known. So no, I think we had the relative privilege of not really being concerned with that.
Another aspect of this advice has to do with what kids will experience at school. In addition to being our morning newscaster here, you've mentioned you used to be a teacher. You also have a podcast about education called No Wrong Answers. And as part of that, you actually talked to teachers about this. What did you hear?
Right. So, yeah, No Wrong Answers is a show where I talk with local teachers about different things happening in the news. And this past week, we did talk about this very topic. And they expressed to me very much what I remember from being a teacher is that your relationships with students start getting built on the first day you have them in class and you say their name on that first day when you have the attendance sheet in front of you and you're calling out names. And, you know, as a teacher, and I mean, I gotta say, as a white guy, my experience was mostly teaching children of color. I taught in Houston, Texas, and in Northern California. And so I knew I was going to make mistakes. And I don't think kids expected me to get their names right the first time or maybe even the second or third time if they had a name that was something that did not, you know, go naturally into my mouth. But they gave me a lot of breaks. If I showed my willingness to learn and be vulnerable and make mistakes, but then say, I'm going to try to learn this. And so that was echoed with the teachers I talked to on No Wrong Answers. I think, you know, relationships can be made or broken just on that very first day when you say a kid's name. And either appear like you're trying to say it right or appear like you don't care.
And we're going to hear from a teacher now who actually is speaking to this idea of kids might get teased if you give them what Dear Abby called a foreign sounding name.
The idea that like a kid could be teased for his name, okay? And then there's a difference between teasing and bullying, and I believe in that, right? Teasing, you know, it's how kids learn how to be social with each other, and what kid has not been teased, right? So my last name is Fox. You don't think I was teased? There has to be a certain sort of resiliency. You have to own who you are.
What do you think about that, Kyle?
Yeah, well, that's Luann Fox. She was she's one of the teachers that's on No Wrong Answers, and she, I think, was making a point that I had actually not thought of, that in fact, having a name that sets you apart when you're a young kid maybe gets you teased, maybe allows other kids to kind of needle at you, can be formative and can be something that allows that child to, in fact, become more proud of their name and more proud of their heritage. Again, if they can survive that. I think she makes the real caveat, right? There's a difference between teasing and bullying. And of course, teasing can go too far, and teasing can lead to more serious concerns down the road. But it was something I had not thought of.
And if someone wants to make fun of your name, they're going to find a way.
Right.
People coughed at me an awful lot.
Yeah.
I want to bring in another voice on this. Aaron Rashawn Thomas is a successful screenwriter in L.A. He's from KCK, and he was quoted in a New York Times response to Dear Abby's column urging parents not to give their kids foreign names or unusual names. Let's hear his story. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent.
Tell me the story of your name, and in particular, your middle name.
Well, my full name is Aaron Rashawn Thomas, which is eerily close to R. Eric Thomas. So I can relate to his name in many ways. But my parents gave me a name that they put a lot of thought into, both creatively and also traditionally. You know, my first name is a Jewish first name. My middle name is a Muslim middle name. And my last name is a Christian last name. Almost by default, last names are complicated when you're an African-American because oftentimes you inherit the last name from probably the family that owned your family as slaves years ago. So there's that. But my dad was a theologian, and he felt like there was nothing more American than to give your son basically names that represented the three major Western religions. And then also my initials, A-R-T, spell art, which is the abbreviation of my grandfather's name, Arthur. So they put a lot of thought into that name, and it's one that I'm definitely proud to carry.
So you got some advice early in your screenwriting career to ditch the Rashawn.
Yes. One of the biggest notes that I received early on is I had a script that I had written, a screenplay, fresh out of film school, and there was a big-time director who read the script and really, really liked it. And as a young writer, that's very flattering. And he had one note, which was also unusual. And the note that he gave me was that, and he thought he was doing me a favor at the time, was he suggested that I keep the ethnic Muslim middle name that I have, Rashawn, off of the title page. And the reasoning that he gave is that for screenplays, when they're read by people, the readers often don't know who the writer is. So the name, just like a student in class on the first day, is the very first identifier of who that person is. And if for some readers they view it as an ethnic writer, it may literally and figuratively color the entire reading experience. And so his suggestion was that by including that middle name, some readers will read the script, any script that you write, as stereotypically Black, with Black, stereotypically Black voices. And for me, hearing that, it actually did the opposite. Instead of determining that to keep the middle name off, I actually determined that from now on, I will definitely keep my middle name on everything that I do because I want that identifier. I want the audience that I'm trying to reach, which are young writers, you know, behind me, and especially young writers of ethnic backgrounds, you know, unheralded voices, to have a chance and understand that there are people doing what they want to do.
What was the emotional? I mean, you've shared sort of the logical conclusion you came to, but what was your emotional response to the suggestion?
The first response, honestly, as an African-American was, and in Hollywood, which is a business that is notorious throughout time of having a terrible history when it comes to judgment of ethnic names. Actors like Charlie Sheen changed his last name because his real last name is Spanish, Estevez, and changed his last name in order to try to gain access to, the Hollywood powers that be. Hollywood racism is as old as Hollywood itself. So I was not surprised by that. That said, I was surprised to hear that in this era, where you're used to hearing those stories in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And that was part of my issue with the note and also with the Dear Abby article, is that at some point you want things to progress, and you understand that it may have been a method of survival at some, at one point to gain access to a business or to an industry. But in this day and age, it feels like we're long past that. This is a time where underrepresented voices should have more of a shot. We shouldn't be behaving the same as we were in 1952. So I wasn't surprised, but at the same time, I was annoyed more than anything. And it actually, to me, became a great motivator.
You know, one of the other people quoted in that New York Times article said that, I think it was someone whose name had been mispronounced by a radio DJ who then said, "Well, I can't pronounce a name like that. Give me a break," something along those lines. And the response was, "You have no trouble pronouncing Tchaikovsky and Dostoevsky. It's not exactly that these names are hard to pronounce, and it's not that they're more foreign." The implication is kind of that it is actually about whiteness and non-whiteness.
Well, that's America. Whiteness is normalized. It has been since the beginning of time, and especially when it comes to the arts and when it comes to pop culture. We are used to, and standards of beauty for that matter, we are used to certain things that are considered to be mainstream, quote unquote, or normal. And anything outside of that is considered the other, and has been for a long time. And really the challenge is right now is, how do we expand that definition of normal, of mainstream, to really, really explore and try to fulfill that American dream?
Let's get some of our callers in on this. I want to talk to Tom in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Gina. Great show. Tom is not my name. I have a very unusual name. And I was a nerd in school until I became an athlete and was not. But because of my name, I took a lot of abuse and a lot of teasing. And somehow I turned that into resilience. And I'm an entrepreneur with several businesses now. But I want to ask parents out there, if you're going to give your kids an exotic or unusual name, are you willing, knowingly, going to give the kid the support he needs to support that name and the culture it represents? Are you willing to go out and promote your culture in a way that's civil and inclusive into our society, which adds to its diversity, which I'm all for, but isn't happening very smoothly right now in current politics? And most importantly, are you willing to get out there and advocate and vote? And I don't see a lot of that happening. I see kids given fancy names they can hardly pronounce, and they're just thrown to the wolves and expected to deal with it. And that's not the way to make inclusivity in our country. So,
Tom,
I don't know that there's a perfect answer. Sure.
I want to get some response to that, but I also want to ask you about, it seems that you, beyond childhood, have continued to use the name Tom rather than the given name you have not yet shared. I'm curious about that.
Is there a question?
Yeah. I'm curious about whether you've ever, do you still feel like, beyond your quote, like, nerdy childhood, you cannot walk around?
Only on Facebook for my high school friends and relationships. They still call me some of the nicknames and tease me. Well, now it's endearing. then it was very, very painful and isolating. And I find myself alone a lot of the times, but which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I had a supportive family at home for every other aspect of my life, which is good, but some of these kids don't. And I worked in childhood development as well as some other things, and I can see the impact it has on some of these kids.
Well, let's get some response. I'm going to let Kyle Palmer respond to this because of his background in education and because of his interactions with teachers for his podcast.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point that Tom made. that I think is counter to maybe something that I said earlier, right, where you can use a name, at least the teachers I've talked to can see that they see students using their names as a way to set themselves apart in a positive way. But I think Tom makes a good point. I will say, you know, Luann, who you heard from earlier, she made the interesting point because she teaches out in Olathe, and she does teach a lot of South Asian students who, because of the population where she lives. And she says that a lot of them, by the time they get to her, when she's a high school teacher, that they do have their, you know, whether it be an Indian or some of them are from China, they do have their names, but they've adopted a Western name like Charlie or Jason or something, you know, that's completely unrelated to their given Indian name, for instance. And that, you know, by the time they get to her, that's what they want to be called. And so she doesn't feel comfortable like trying to push them and say, well, you know, do you really want to be called that? Or would you rather be called by, you know, your given name? So she accepts what, you know, what they tell her. But it has, I think, for some teachers opened up a conversation about, you know, what are kids, how much agency do kids really have?
There is an amazing book about that, actually, by Jhumpa Lahiri. It's called The Namesake. Have you read that?
Yes, yeah.
I also recommend that. I guess I'm recommending a lot of things today. Anyway, let's get back to our callers. We'll speak now with Shelley in Leawood. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Gina. Hi, Kyle. How are you?
Great.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great show, by the way. I just wanted to make two comments. One is there might be a generational difference here. I'm of East Indian heritage, much like Kyle's wife, and also much like her, I've never lived in India. And I was born in London in the UK. And when I was born, my parents had a similar struggle of what to name me, you know, their firstborn child living in the UK, knowing they would not go back to India. And it turned out that when I was born, they gave me an Indian name, a traditional Indian name, and 7 days later, after getting home, my mom changed it to Shelley, thinking that we're going to be living in the UK and in the Western Hemisphere from now on. Let's not give her an Indian name. Well, since then, you know, I've been Shelley my whole life, and it's been fine. But now I'm married, have two daughters, and we had a similar discussion between my husband and I, and we chose the exact opposite decision. So we, you know, we know we're going to be, you know, we're settled here in the U.S. in Leawood, Kansas, and we chose to give traditional Indian names to our two daughters. And it's been a great thing. You know, we made sure that they were shorter. You know, my last name is 12 letters long, so it's a long last name. So we didn't want their first name to be as long, but we did want it to have meaning and for them to know what the meanings were of their names and to be proud of their names, even though they might get teased at school, even though they might get a lot of repetitions or mispronunciations. This is their name. This is who they represent. And I was surprised. Like, my daughters now are 8 and 2. And in second grade, my daughter wrote down the 3 best things that she likes about herself. And the first thing she said was, it's her name. And I was like, wow, you know, her name is the first thing you like about yourself, which really surprised me. So I think there might be a generational gap
generational
what my
thing.
Parents had chosen for me.
Yeah.
And what
Shelley,
we chose for our kids.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a generational shift is an interesting one. I mean, and also just it gets back to this idea that you actually never know how the meaning of a name is going to change in our culture, no matter what the name is. My dad was named Herbert Hoover Kaufman the year before the stock market crashed. Yeah. That did not go well. And the whole idea was for his immigrant parents to establish that this child was all American. You know what I mean?
It didn't change it to Franklin Delano Roosevelt the next year.
That might have been a good idea. Aaron Rashawn Thomas, what I haven't acknowledged yet is that you are also a parent. How did these questions come into your choices as you named your own children?
It's always been a really big consideration. My family takes great pride in giving a lot of thought to our names. And actually, my wife, who was Ghanaian, Ghanaian immigrant, you know, had more of a name battle than I did. Her full name is Asantewa Kumi. And her nickname in Ghana is Ama. And in arriving in America, in order to help pronunciation in classrooms, she just went by Ama, the shortened name. And so when it came time for us, and we have 3 lovely daughters, you know, what we made a decision of is whether or not we wanted them to have unique names that would allow them to build character and or to make sure that, you know, everyone around them would be able to pronounce their names. And it's a heavy consideration. I think, you know, and what we found with our three daughters is that by having a unique name, it actually allows you to really define yourself. You know, I mean, definitely everyone gets teased, and that's a strong, you know, consideration. You don't want your kids to get teased. But at the same time, I've found that with all three of our daughters, and all three have unique names, you know, it's completely defined them in a way where all three of them have developed strong backbones.
Aaron,
so I think that's a positive thing.
Aaron Rashawn Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks, Gina.
And Kyle Palmer, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Gina.
We are off to a break. KCUR Central Standard will be right back. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in case you missed this small news item in the grand scheme of things, Volkswagen recently announced that they're discontinuing production of the iconic VW Bug in 2019. It's a sad bit of news for nostalgic road trippers who used to punch siblings' arms while playing slug bug. And considering it's kind of a statement car in a way, people who love it for a reason. So our producer, Melody Rowell, went to the Mocan Volkswagen Club's monthly meeting to get reactions.
So what is it about Volkswagens in general that you love, and the Bug specifically?
Oh, shoot, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I've been asked that a lot of times. And when I was a kid, I was a big fan of the Herbie movies. I don't know if I liked Volkswagens and therefore I liked Herbie movies, or if I liked Herbie movies and therefore I liked Volkswagens. It's a chicken and the egg question. I'll never know.
My first three cars were Volkswagen Beetles, a 64, a 63, and a 71 Super Beetle. It was the people's car. It is extremely easy to work on. The engine comes out in 10 minutes. And they're just very simplistic in all the design and the way the original Beetle was made.
It's just a fun little car to drive and great gas mileage, and you know, anybody with any kind of mechanical sense can fix it. So, I mean, it's a great car.
So what was your reaction when you saw that Volkswagen was going to cease production of the Bug?
I really wish they hadn't. The Beetle is kind of an iconic design, although they have changed it over the years with technology and design changes.
Well, after driving that 2018 a couple of weekends ago, I think it's probably a mistake, because that little car ran really well, and it was absolutely a blast to drive.
Volkswagen's really screwing up when they're stopping production. They just didn't give it enough time to take hold.
So, yeah, it's kind of sad. I'm kind of sad that it's not more popular. I don't think I want one myself, but I wish other people did.
Aw, so sad. Well, before we go today, let's hear more about the Bug with Nicole Wakelin, a freelance automotive journalist. Nicole, what is the story of the Bug?
Well, they're all right. What you're hearing them say is that it's sort of this beloved car, that everybody likes it, and that it's cute and it's fun and it's been around for so many years. There's a lot of nostalgia, like that one person mentioned about the Herbie the Love Bug. Like, who doesn't want a car that squirts oil at your enemies? You know, it's a fun
little
car.
I definitely want that.
Yeah, like, who doesn't want that? But the problem is the market's changed a lot. It's not that Volkswagen wants to kill all your dreams. It's that people aren't buying small cars like they used to.
There are, though. There is, like, it does maybe, what about if it were, like, the Volkswagen Bug hybrid? Because that seems like the exception to that rule, maybe.
Well, even hybrids, that's not enough to save it. I mean, there's so many things out there that you can get as hybrids. You can get big full-size SUVs as hybrids now. But what Volkswagen's doing is not so much saying, well, let's make a hybrid Bug. They're actually kind of going a different direction, and they're going to make an electrified version of the old VW microbus. So they're taking a different piece of nostalgia in a different direction.
So the microbus is going to be their nostalgia car, and then they'll keep the Jetta for, like, mainstream needs?
Yeah, I would say that they're going to call the new microbus the ID Buzz, so it also gets a fun little updated jazzy name. But yeah, so they're taking that. They still recognize that the nostalgia of some of their vehicles really holds a place with people. They just are trying to cater to a market that doesn't want little cars and wants something that can carry the whole family.
How did the Volkswagen Bug become this iconic, not just an iconic car, but like an iconic part of our visual landscape?
Well, you know, it has sort of inauspicious beginnings. It was 1938, and Adolf Hitler was the one who really pushed this. It was sort of his dream car, and he got it going. And since then, I mean, you think that's a long time ago, and that is not someplace that you really want to start with a brand and start with a vehicle. But by the time the 60s come in the United States, it's now the car of people who are, you know, trying to fight the man, and it becomes a big part of the sort of counterculture move that was happening at that time. And, you know, it was cheap, it was easy to maintain, and it had the right feel and spirit that just kind of held on and kept it until, again, times just changed enough that that first Volkswagen Beetle sort of faded, and it was a little gap, and then they came out with a new Beetle, and now that one's fading into the sunset as well.
So the Beetle and the Bug, these names, they are not nicknames. They're actually like, that's the model of this car.
Yeah, it was called the Volkswagen Beetle. I think the very first thing before it really was produced back in like the 30s, I think it was just called the Type 1. It didn't even have a cute name, just Type 1. But the German name, which, like, don't try, make me try. I can't say it in German, but it was actually translated to Beetle. So it looks like that. It's a cute name for the car. But yeah, it went from the Volkswagen Beetle, which they call the classic Beetle, to the new Beetle, which is the one that came around in 97. And they give it one more little facelift in a new generation in 2011, and they're just calling it again the Beetle, and that's how it will go out, is just the Beetle.
There's, when it comes to like the sort of idea of who drives this Bug, I was interested that all of the people we heard from in that clip were men. My reason for that surprise is that I read an article a while back. It was sort of like a profile of different jobs people have. And this one woman, the job she had that was being profiled is that she worked for Volkswagen, and her entire job was to make sure that in the intricacies of the design of these cars, that they appealed specifically to women. And she went into great detail about exactly how the Bug appeals to women and how updates in the design of the Bug appeal to women. And I'm interested in that as something that Volkswagen generally with their brand has been trying to do.
Yeah, I think with the Beetle, it did have a huge amount of appeal to women, especially the new Beetle when it was introduced in 97. And they were finding it was a lot of women who were purchasing the car. Not that guys weren't buying it. And obviously there's a lot of fans that you spoke to, you know, that really like it, that are men. But it, you know, there's something about, look, it's a cute car. It's a fun little car. It's not exactly a beefy, burly, manly vehicle. So even though men like it, it really innately appeals to a lot of women. And there are a lot of women who are huge fans of the vehicle.
And then, like, if I had never thought about it before, but Volkswagen commercials tend to show people putting like groceries in the car as opposed to like careening around mountain curves.
Right. Well, because the idea way back when it first came out was a car that technically a family could use. You could put a little bit of stuff in the back. You could put your kids in there. Your husband and wife could be in there, and it could serve as a car for the family. Even though what we think of a family cars now are far larger, you know, the crossovers,
big
and the
equals
SUVs,
family.
Right, that you could kind of like park a Beetle in the back of some of these big SUVs. They're so huge. The Beetle still has its usefulness. It still has plenty of room for cargo. The seats fold. You know, it gives you some versatility. So it's not just a matter of you got a car that seats two people and it's tiny, cramped little thing. It actually, it functions as a car you can get around with every day, and you can take stuff around in it.
And can I just say, I remember from this article too, that the cup holder had like a dual function as a vase for flowers.
Well, actually, when it came out in 97, it was the vase. There was a vase, and it was just at the top, sort of by the steering wheel, like on the right-hand side. And there was a teeny little, like, think of it like a bud vase, and you could stick a flower. And you would see people with flowers in it, and in the springtime, it would be daisies. And in the fall, it would be some little orange flowers. And at Christmas, people would have little sprigs of holly. And it,
how can this
made
not
it, like,
work?
A seasonal thing. Yeah.
But that's a serious question. How can that not work? How can a car with this unique, like, presence not work?
It worked for a while. I mean, 97, that's, and it's discontinued. The last ones roll off the production line next summer. So that makes it like just over 20 years. That's a good run for a car that actually started in 38, you know, and times have changed a lot. It's just, and Volkswagen will tell you that, you know, never say never. It doesn't mean that somewhere down the line, what people want, what Volkswagen's building, what they feel like is going to work for their market, doesn't suddenly make the Beetle a proposition they want to go back to. But for right now, right this moment, where it's at is crossovers and SUVs, and that is not what the Beetle is.
So cars stay on the road a while after they cease to be produced. How long do you predict we're going to be playing Slugbug?
Oh, forever. If with any luck, forever.
Forever. You heard it here first. Nicole Wakelin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nicole is an automotive journalist, and she weighed in on the death of the VW bug, the imminent death, I should say. As of 2019. That is a wrap for today's show. You can listen back to any of our conversations. We had a packed hour today. They'll all be available at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And just a reminder that during this election season, we have been speaking with first-time voters. We're looking for more stories, particularly people who are motivated by the political climate to vote for the first time ever. If you are that person or know someone who is, tell us about it. kcur.org/firstvote. That's kcur.org/firstvote. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.